Hello, everyone, and welcome to the American Immigration Lawyers Association's podcast entitled Lessons from Around the Circuits. I'm J.J. Area, ALIS Education Associate, and it is my pleasure to introduce today's panel. The discussion leader for this podcast is Justin Burton from Chicago, Illinois. Joining Justin is Joe Reyna from Dallas, Texas, and Mary Kinney, Senior Staff Attorney at the American Immigration Council from Washington, D.C. At this time, I'd like to turn the podcast over to Justin.
Thank you, JJ. My name is Justin Burton. I'm an immigration attorney, a private practitioner in Chicago, Illinois, and I'm honored to be on this podcast along with Mary Kinney and Joe Reyna, who both have more than 20 years of experience, which is a few more than my years of experience, which I'm roughly sitting at about 16 years of experience. Today, we are going to be discussing admission under the Immigration and Nationality Act and case law, as well availabilities of waivers and motions to suppress. Mary is going to start us off on admissions pursuant to the Immigration and Nationality Act. And Mary, what is an admission for purposes of immigration law?
Thank you, Justin. That is a great question, and unfortunately, there's not a simple answer to that. The Immigration and Nationality Act, INA Section 101A13, capital A, defines an admission as the lawful entry into the U.S. following an inspection and authorization by an immigration officer. So you would think, okay, there's a definition that's pretty straightforward and pretty simple. And it's true that this definition is generally applied, but there are quite a few exceptions. Both the board and courts have held that events other than a lawful entry can constitute an admission. So we're going to talk today a little bit about the general definition and how it's been interpreted, and then also go into some of the other circumstances in which either the board or the courts have found that an admission took place even though it didn't satisfy the definition.
Well, before we get into that, what's the real significance of an admission into the United States?
The term admission is used repeatedly, dozens of times, in the Immigration and Nationality Statute, and it really comes into play in quite a few contexts. I'll give you just a few examples just to sort of show the variety of ways that it's important in handling removal cases or any cases, affirmative applications also. So first of all, the question of whether a person is an, quote, applicant for admission, end quote, governs the procedures and the standards to be applied at the point in time in which they're entering the United States, and that's pursuant to INA Section 235. So that's sort of initially where it comes into play. Later, it's an essential eligibility requirement for adjustment of status. An individual has to be under INA 245A. The individual must be either admitted or paroled into the United States. Certain forms of relief from removal require a showing of admission. So, for example, with respect to LPR cancellation of removal, which is INA Section 245A, the person has to show 7 years of continuous residence after having been, quote, admitted in any status. Certain waivers involve admission. We'll talk a little bit more later about INA Section 237A1H, which waives the ground of removal based upon an individual being inadmissible at the time of, quote, admission due to a misrepresentation. So that's one example. And then finally, even the nature of the charges that the government can bring against an individual in removal proceedings hinge on whether or not that individual has been admitted. So where a person has been admitted, the removal ground has to fall within the deportation grounds, which are in INA 237. If the person has not been admitted, then they fall within the exclusion grounds, which are found at INA, or the inadmissibility grounds, which are found at INA Section 212.
And I guess that would also affect eligibility for bond and determining whether somebody is bond eligible or not as well.
That's correct, yes.
How about the term lawful entry? What does that definition of a lawful entry mean, and what does it require?
That's a good question. So the statutory definition says specifically states that it has to be a lawful entry into the U.S. And both courts and the board have held, and the board held this in a precedent decision, that that term only requires that the entry be procedurally lawful. It doesn't have to be substantively lawful. And where this comes up most often is in cases that involve a wave through at the port of entry. So an individual comes up to the port of entry, doesn't say anything, isn't asked any questions. The inspecting officer simply waves the individual through, whether it be, you know, the person's in a car or on foot, through the port of entry and allows them to enter. The board found in a case many, many years ago, in matter of Araguian, that that was an admission. And then subsequently, in a case called Matter of Quilantan, which is a BIA decision from 2010, the board held that that wave through inspection is procedurally lawful, affirming Matter of Araguian, and moreover, that it satisfies the statutory definition in 101A13.
So this will oftentimes come up in the context of adjustment of status, whereby the person would claim to be admitted to the United States through this procedural regularity. How does one go about showing that or describing that?
That's a good question, and that's where things get a little harder, because both USCIS and some immigration judges, depending on whether the adjustment application is affirmative or defensively filed, the USCIS or IJs will require evidence to demonstrate that the individual was actually waved through. Some offices allow the testimony of the individual and find that that is sufficient to demonstrate that that the person was waved through. Others say, no, that's never sufficient and require additional evidence. And, of course, in many cases, the wave through might have happened years earlier, and, you know, the person either might have been alone, or if there was a passenger in the car, that individual may no longer be in touch with the passenger, or the passenger may be afraid to come forward and submit testimony because of his or her own status. So it can be difficult to get corroborating evidence to support the testimony of the adjustment applicant.
I think the most frustrating is the varying standards of what all the offices require. Where you're right, some do require perhaps just an affidavit or testimony in support of it. Others require a bit more, like a stamp and a passport showing they flew into Canada or otherwise. Speaking about the wave-through scenario, what's the difference between a parole and perhaps an admission?
The difference is that a parole is not an admission, and in fact the statutory definition makes that clear, that a person who's been paroled under INA 212D5 for humanitarian reasons has not been admitted into the U.S. Of course, a parole does satisfy the eligibility requirement for adjustment because INA 245, the adjustment statute, 245A, says that an individual is eligible for adjustment if he or she has either been admitted or paroled. So you need either the admission or the parole.
Okay.
But they are
so
distinct.
If somebody already has been admitted to the United States and they're returning back to the United States, would that person, let's say a permanent resident, be seeking admission again each and every time?
No, and again, this is covered in the statutory definition. 101A13C specifies that for returning LPR, the general rule is that that individual will not be found to be seeking admission. There are six exceptions to that, however, and in 2015, in the case Matter of Pena, which was a precedential BIA decision, the board held that an LPR cannot be regarded as seeking admission and can't be charged under the ground of inadmissibility, Section 212, one of those grounds, unless he or she falls within one of the six exceptions. So in other words, the general rule will apply. The individual, the LPR, will be found not to be seeking admission and therefore will be considered to already have been admitted. And if they are placed in removal proceedings, the individual will be charged under Section 237 unless one of the six exceptions in the statute is found to apply.
And so Section 212 would be, for instance, now, perhaps crimes or terrorism grounds or abandoning residence overseas, perhaps. Is that right?
That's right. Or anybody who was inadmissible at the time of admission, yeah. So, misrepresentation grounds or a whole number of grounds in 212.
Are there ever circumstances in which an individual would be considered to have been admitted, even if her entry did not satisfy the statutory definition for admission?
Yeah, and this is where the whole concept of admission gets much more complicated because, as I indicated earlier, both courts and the board have found that the statutory definition generally applies, but not always. Sometimes there are other things that constitute an admission, even though they don't satisfy that statutory definition. And so the biggest one is adjustment of status, and there are cases that go both ways on that issue. The board generally has found that an adjustment of status is equivalent to an admission and therefore satisfies any requirement for an admission. In a recent decision, perhaps the most recent decision is a case entitled Matter of Agour, A-G-O-U-R. It's a 2015 decision where the board found that an adjustment of status was an admission for purposes of determining eligibility for the Section 237A1H waiver. And this is the waiver that applies in deportation proceedings to waive a ground of deportability that's based on an individual who was inadmissible at admission due to a misrepresentation. But in contrast to that, there are numerous courts of appeals decisions that have rejected the BIA's interpretation of the aggravated felony bar in Section 212H as applying. The board had previously found that this applied, that this bar to the waiver found in Section 212H applied to aggravated felons who gained their permanent resident status through an adjustment. The language of 212H of the aggravated felony bar says that the bar applies to a person who was previously admitted as an LPR. The courts looked at that language and said, okay, if you were previously admitted as an LPR, then under the statutory definition, that requires an entry. And an adjustment of status does not require an entry, and therefore an adjustment of status doesn't satisfy this language, doesn't demonstrate that the individual was previously admitted as an LPR. Instead, the bar would only apply if the individual was admitted as an LPR at a port of entry. So the courts rejected the board's earlier earlier finding that an adjustment, you know, that an individual had who'd gotten their LPR status through an adjustment would be covered by the bar and would be ineligible for the waiver. Subsequent to all these court decisions, the board finally withdrew those earlier decisions and in 2015 entered a decision that was consistent with the courts. It's a case called Matter of JHJ. So that's now universal around the country.
And that is 26 INN decision 563 BIA 2015.
That's correct.
Are there any situations other than adjustment of status where the courts or the BIA have considered a grant of a benefit that constitutes an admission?
Yeah, this is really a developing area of the law. Right now, there are several. One is where an individual has been granted TPS, So if the individual is a TPS recipient, the Sixth Circuit, in a case called Flores v. USCIS, 718 F3rd 548, it's a 2013 decision, the Sixth Circuit held that that grant of TPS constitutes an admission for purposes of adjustment of status. So the individual in that case was seeking to adjust based on a marriage to a U.S. citizen, and the had never been admitted to the United States. The at a port of entry, at least, had never been admitted to the United States, and the court adopted the individual's arguments that when he was granted TPS, he was, quote, admitted for purposes of adjustment of status. And the court's reasoning was really hinged on the language in the TPS statute. So it was very specific to that language, and the court found that that language in the TPS statute indicated Congress's intent that that it be considered an adjustment, it can be considered an admission for purposes of adjustment. The 11th Circuit ruled the opposite in a case called Serrano v. U.S. Attorney. It's a 2011 decision. Subsequently, there have been several favorable district court decisions, and the issue is pending right now at the Ninth Circuit. So that's an issue that's going to continue to evolve. The Ninth Circuit, it's the only circuit that has held that a person who is accepted into the Family Unity Program has been admitted in any status. The Family Unity Program requires that the individual demonstrate that he or she was admitted in any status and for purposes of cancellation of removal. And the The cancellation statute requires a showing that the individual was admitted in any status. And what the Ninth Circuit held in a case called Garcia Quintero v. Gonzalez was that a grant or acceptance into the Family Unity Program constituted an admission in any status. The board since rejected that in a case entitled a precedent decision entitled Matter of Garcia Quintero, and the board's decision applies around. I'm looking at my notes and they're confusing. The board's decision was a case called Fajardo Espinosa. It's 26 INN decision 603, BIA 2015. It rejected the Ninth Circuit decision Garcia Quintero. And so it applies everywhere other than the Ninth Circuit.
How about in the context, so the TPS works as now in some circuits as an admission. And so under the same context, how about when somebody's granted a U visa from entering the United States without inspection to them being granted a U visa, is that being considered an admission to the United States?
Well, as far as I know, that's also a developing issue. The board, there's currently a decision, a case before the board in which one of the issues that the board is looking at is that exactly whether such a grant of U visa status constitutes an admission for purposes of adjustment. I understand that some USCIS offices will, that in some cases USCIS will find that the grant of the U visa status was an admission, but not universally.
I've heard that as well. Now, once somebody is admitted or not admitted to the United States, there's a number of waivers. And Joe, perhaps you can enlighten us on some of these waivers and start off with what happens if somebody commits a crime? Is there a waiver available for that in certain situations?
Well, sure. Probably the most commonly used waiver where criminal issues are concerned is the waiver found in Section 212H of the Act. And before getting into some of the thorny issues, I'll just point out briefly that that waiver really exists in two forms. One is under 212H1A, which can be used if the applicant or the alien is inadmissible only for a prostitution-related offense or committed the act or acts triggering the inadmissibility more than 15 years before the date of the application for a visa or adjustment or what have you. And in that case, the individual does not have to demonstrate extreme hardship to a qualifying relative, only has to demonstrate rehabilitation, and that the his admission would not undermine the security or the welfare of the United States. The more commonly used waiver, because people seem to have always seemed to commit the triggering offenses within the previous 15 years, is the one in which people rely on extreme hardship to a permanent resident or a citizen who's a spouse, a parent, or son or daughter. The availability of that waiver in at least two circumstances, one of which Mary mentioned, is intertwined with admission. The one that she addressed is, and is I think pretty much now well settled, is that the language in 212H that purports to disqualify permanent residents from 212H eligibility if they either haven't lived in the United States 7 years or have been convicted of an aggravated felony, I think now what you could almost say universally, with the exception of perhaps in the Eighth Circuit, it's accepted that if an adjustment does not constitute the type of admission contemplated by the language in that disqualifies those permanent residents, so a person who adjusted and did not enter the United States with an immigrant visa would still be eligible for that waiver, even if he's been convicted of an aggravated felony or has not lived in the United States for the 7 years preceding the initiation of the proceedings.
When seeking the waiver in that posture, can you just file a 212H waiver on the court after you've already received your green card or been in the United States for 7 years? Or do you need to be able to readjust, or is there another way to deal with it?
Well, that deals with the other aspect of it. A someone who has already been admitted, I think now it's pretty well settled, cannot use the 212H waiver to readjust. Can use the 212H waiver to readjust, but only to readjust. So if the alien is in and admitted to the United States and needs a 212H waiver because of a criminal issue, then he will need to file for adjustment of status. Unfortunately, there are instances in which an individual does not have a qualifying relative and obviously going to be a situation where, since proceedings are initiated, the individual needs an immediate relative. So a citizen spouse or an adult citizen son or daughter to file a petition and then create the availability of an immigrant visa so that the individual can apply for adjustment concurrently with the 212H waiver. There are instances, many cases, obviously, and I think Mary alluded to them, there are instances in which the government argues that the person has been admitted to the United States. For example, in the aggravated felony context, an aggravated felony conviction after admission triggers deportability. Well, people used to argue, well, I was adjusted, so I wasn't admitted to the United States. And the government prevailed essentially and said, that's an admission for purposes of your deportability. But the context of the waiver in 212H, it's such a situation that from time to time it benefits the government if the alien has been admitted, and that then he can't seek the waiver as a standalone waiver, because if the person is not in the United States, then he can apply for the waiver as on its own without having to file for adjustment of status. And that's how the law was from 1980, when the board decided Sanchez, but then in 2013, the board decided Matter of Rivas and said, they basically said, we're doing away with this. We're not going to have any more standalone waiver or the nunk-pro-tunk issuance of the waiver as if you were at the border seeking admission. And the other circuits, and Rivas, by the way, was essentially affirmed in the 11th Circuit. And since then, the courts that have addressed this, the 3rd, the 5th, the 7th, and the 9th, have all sustained Rivas and agree. So the only way to seek the 212H waiver alone for someone who's already in the United States as a permanent resident and has been admitted is to be outside the United States effectively seeking admission. So if one idea would be if you have a client in that situation, it might be better for the client to depart the United States and attempt to return so that the waiver can be used on its own without the need of filing a concurrent adjustment of status. And there have been cases where that's occurred, and then the government's been put in, I think, what's an awkward position, arguing that the alien has been admitted, although the alien, under the way the statute is worded, is really at the border seeking admission.
I just want to make sure I understand it. So if somebody's coming into the United States and they catch them coming into the border, that person, even though they were a permanent resident of the United States, would be eligible for the 212H waiver. But once they're admitted to the United States, that might cause the issue?
Right. Correct. Okay. And then this is – I don't believe that there's a precedent decision on this issue directly, but the issue has been addressed before the board and in an unpublished decision, at least one in which we were involved. A person who was a permanent resident was accused of aggravated assault on a public servant. He was arrested. He posted bond. He thought he was going to leave the United States and not come back. He decided to come back and face the charges. Now, he had only been charged and he hadn't been convicted. 101A13C states that if you have committed the acts, you are viewed as an arriving alien, unless a waiver has been granted. When he arrived at the border in a vehicle driven by his mother, his alien registration receipt card was entered into the system. It set off alarms. He was removed quickly and forcibly from his vehicle and was asked if he knew why this was going on, and he said yes. And he told them in a sit-down session at the port of entry that, yes, he'd been arrested, and he committed those crimes, and he was returning to the United States to pay his debt to society. And he was handed off to the custody of a sheriff's deputy. There were no parole documents issued. His green card was not returned. He was never released from custody. And then he was convicted and went directly to prison for 6.5 years. And he did not have an immediate relative, so he could not have readjust. And so we had to argue that he was eligible for the standalone waiver. And, of course, the government resisted that strenuously. And the immigration judge agreed with the government, and we went to the board and pointed out that there was no authority for government officials to admit to the United States an alien who was inadmissible. And he was clearly seeking admission. And the government's argument was, we did that but by mistake, but that's still an admission, and that's why he's ineligible for the waiver. We pointed out there's quite a long string of case law that states that unless there's evidence to the contrary, the law presumes that government officials act out and carry out their duties correctly and lawfully and in good faith. And the board said, unless the government can find some evidence to the contrary, which you're welcome to do on remand, this guy's eligible for the waiver. So it gets into a very delicate issue. I think, honestly, that Rivas should have been decided that way, but it was not, and that was sustained in the 11th Circuit. There's a 5th Circuit case where a permanent resident returned to the United States unlawfully, but he still had a green card, and he had been ordered removed as an aggravated felon. He landed at DFW Airport, and he was detained after going through immigration but before leaving the customs enclosure. And because he had not made it through the customs enclosure, the 5th Circuit said he was an arriving alien and he couldn't be treated as being present in the United States unlawfully after having been deported. So that was not decided in the context of the waiver availability, but I think it's a helpful decision. So it's an issue certainly to keep in mind, especially since now the standalone waiver is, as I put it, very nearly extinct.
So when you first started discussing 212H waivers, or generally in most of the scenarios we find ourselves in, you seek a 212 waiver along with an adjustment of status application, or if somebody's trying to consular process, you file a 212H waiver in the United States based off of a denial or a ground of inadmissibility to the United States. But is there a context where you're dealing with marijuana or drugs and you're able to seek that waiver pursuant to 212H?
Yes, and that is the ability of or availability of the 212H waiver for someone who's had a marijuana possession or drug possession has been the subject of recent litigation. I think we can expect to see more of it, which is why I think it's a particularly important area for immigration lawyers to be aware of. Part of it involves the interplay or the difference between the language in 212H and 237A2B. It's not that it should necessarily involve that, but it does, because the board has addressed the deportability exception in 237 and seems kind of inclined to treat it in the same way it treats the language in 212H. But in 237, the act states that a person who's in the United States like a permanent resident and is convicted of a controlled substance violation other than a single offense involving possession for one's own use of 30 grams of marijuana or less is deportable. Now, the language in 212H is very similar. It states that the waiver can eliminate or waive the inadmissibility of an alien insofar as it relates to a single offense of simple possession of 30 grams or less of marijuana. So in the language of the waiver, it uses the word simple possession, but does not use the words for one's own use. And both sections refer to a single offense. The board seems to conclude that someone is only within that deportability exception. So you get busted with 24 grams of marijuana and it's yours and that's all you have with you. The board seems to say, okay, you're clearly within the deportability exception. However, if the individual, for example, was in prison, there's a case that holds, no, possession in prison is different. Well, that's not actually how the statute reads. And there's a Fifth Circuit case recently decided, Flores-Esquivel, it's a 2015 case by the Fifth Circuit, that said personal use, a possession conviction for personal use, even in a drug-free zone, is within the deportability exception. The board doesn't like that. The board seems to feel, no, this exception is for the lowest possible level of a crime. So if it's in a drug-free zone, if it is in prison, if it's while you're in a vehicle and you could be driving, we view that as most seriously, and it's not within that exception. And I think the direction the board is going in, and maybe a couple of the circuits will, we don't know yet, is one in which they will hold that in the same way for the 212H waiver. Now, the 212H waiver, the Eighth Circuit says, can waive a paraphernalia conviction because it relates to possession. The Seventh Circuit says that. But, for example, the Eighth Circuit says, but not if the paraphernalia is in a vehicle. That's a more serious crime, so you can't use a 212H waiver.
Now, how about, and just to keep this moving, cancellation of removal? Let's say you're placed before the immigration court, completely unrelated to marijuana, but other offenses, seeking cancellation removal and perhaps a waiver before the immigration court. What is cancellation removal?
Well, of course, it exists in two forms. There's cancellation of removal for someone who's not a permanent resident. Obviously, one of the hardest or most difficult types of relief to gain because of the requirement. Besides being in the United States for 10 years, being a person of good moral character, not having certain disqualifying convictions, it also requires demonstrating the exceptional and extremely unusual hardship to the qualifying relative. the permanent resident can also apply for cancellation of removal. And the requirements are at least 5 years as a permanent resident, at least 7 years in the United States after having been admitted in any status. This is where you have this interplay, like what Mary was talking about, the court saying being having family unity is an admission. Well, that might give someone the additional time that's needed if they were admitted and then 4 or so or 3 years later or 2 years later became permanent residents, then they might be able to stack the time together. So that's when that those kinds of issues relate to one another and they become pretty critical. In the context of cancellation, I'm sorry?
I was going to ask, in the context of cancellation, what happens if you're dealing with aggravated felonies?
Right. Well, the permanent resident, besides having the 7 years and the five years as a resident, 7 years after having been admitted in any status, cannot seek cancellation if he's been convicted of an aggravated felony. And so those three things must be satisfied, and then after that, the case becomes essentially a discretionary waiver rooted in the factors enumerated in matter of CBT and in matter of Marin, the much older 212C case. But where you have a little bit more possibility for disagreement in the circuits is, as far as eligibility for the waiver, is the stop time rule, the so-called stop time rule, because the continuous residence needed for the 7 years or for the 10 years ends either when the alien commits an offense that makes him inadmissible or deportable, or when the notice to appear is served. Now, most circuits seem to read that just black and white and say, the day that the notice to appear is issued, that's the day that stops your time. If on that day you didn't have the 7 years, it's too bad, you're out of luck. Or if you didn't have the 10. Now, the Second Circuit and the Seventh, although I don't believe in the wording of their the case is quite as strong, oddly, the Seventh Circuit decided it first, and the Second Circuit says they're saying it, they're agreeing, but the Second Circuit's pronouncement is more forceful than the Seventh, in my opinion. But those two courts have said, if you issue an NTA and you don't have a date and time of the hearing on the NTA, it reads to be determined, as it seems to in almost all cases, and then later a hearing notice is issued, the date of the hearing notice completes the action required under Section 239 to initiate the proceedings, and then the date of the hearing notice is the day that stops the accrual of the continuous residence. And that's one area where not necessarily will all the circuits agree, and it is a very, very good area for lawyers to be careful of and see if they can mount an objection or build their eligibility on that question. And because there's some disagreement in the circuits, reading those cases and the dissents within each of on both sides is going to provide helpful information.
Joe, before we get into motions to suppress, can you briefly touch on, and that leaves us about 10 minutes to discuss motions to suppress, can you briefly discuss 212I waivers?
Yes, the 212I waiver waives the inadmissibility of someone for fraud or misrepresentation. 212A6C, little I, makes inadmissible an alien who has committed a fraud or willful misrepresentation. And the C2, incidentally, C2 makes inadmissible without waiver someone who's made a false claim to citizenship. That's just absolutely deadly. But C1 can be waived using the waiver found in Section 212I of the Act.
Is it similar to the 212H waiver?
It's similar. There is one very notable exception, and that is that sons and daughters are not qualifying relatives for the waiver. So if you have the alien has a spouse who's a permanent resident or U.S. citizen, or has a parent who is a permanent resident or a U.S. citizen, the waiver is accessible. He has the qualifying relative. If the applicant, for example, is one of the millions of people in this country who are undocumented and has a U.S. citizen child, that child is not a qualifying relative and would leave the person without access to the waiver. And so that's a striking difference between the two of the waivers. Of course, the hardship standard is the same, and it's narrowly construed. And as far as how the waivers applied across the circuits, a decision on that waiver is not something that can be litigated in court. It's the discretionary decision. So
That applies to all of these waivers, right? That applies to every single one of these waivers that we discussed, including adjustment. Everything is
correct. That's why we'll... Right, and that's why really the most of what I've been talking about is whether the waiver is even available on a legal issue. Now, one of the things that's not actually so much part of the waiver of 212i, but it is important, is to ask first, is my client really subject to the 212A6CI? In other words, has he actually made a willful misrepresentation or committed a fraud? And not all the circuits see it in the same way. For example, the First Circuit, they believe in the First Circuit that an adverse credibility finding and a willful misrepresentation are not one and the same concept. Adverse credibility does not necessarily equal a willful misrepresentation. That's a 2005 case called Singh versus Gonzalez. Now, the Fourth Circuit agrees, and they say, the Fourth Circuit says, inconsistency between an asylum application and the applicant's testimony does not amount to a willful misrepresentation. That's a much more recent case out of the Fourth Circuit called, I'm going to mispronounce this, Qing Yang Yang versus Holder from 2014. Now,
Joe,
sorry to cut you off,
but we're running out a little bit of time. Perhaps people can reach out to you on intent and fraud and whether they actually are subject to 212A6 before they leap into the 212I waivers. Mary, maybe you can bring us up to speed on motions to suppress. They've been fairly active and a hot topic. Perhaps you can describe what they are and the basis to seeking suppression motions.
I'm sorry, I was on mute. A motion to suppress seeks to exclude unlawfully obtained evidence from the record. And so generally, the evidence that the individual seeking to exclude is the evidence that the government is relying on to meet its initial burden of proving that the respondent is a non-citizen. And if the evidence is actually suppressed and the government fails to meet its burden, the proceedings are going to be terminated. So the standard for succeeding with a motion to suppress is that the respondent must show that the evidence sought to be excluded resulted from an egregious constitutional violation by government agents. And I'm not going to get into the case law that has developed around this in terms in removal proceedings, because the American Immigration Council, my organization, has three very extensive practice advisories on motions to suppress. So I'm going to encourage you, if this is an issue that you're dealing with in one of your cases, to go to our website and find those practice advisories. The first is a general overview and includes both the law and cases from around the country, and a discussion of the Fourth Amendment, a discussion of the Fifth Amendment, and a discussion of the mechanics of filing such a motion. The other two address the more particular situation of, in one, the situation in which local police cooperate with ICE agents, and in the other where CBP officers are the or agents are the individuals who have made the arrest and committed the constitutional violation.
Joe, perhaps when you're in immigration court, how do you treat motions to suppress and how do you move forward with them? Do you object to evidence that they're seeking to introduce, or do you put together a formal motion to suppress?
Sometimes I have found that I needed to make the motion extemporaneously in court, but most of the time we've been able to find out in advance how the arrest took place, particularly if we have an I-213 that contains a narrative and explains why or how an individual came to the attention of the agency or was stopped or that sort of thing. But I prefer, if possible, prepare a formal motion and attach to the motion evidence, an affidavit that is very specific, and rather than do it orally only. Of course, in court, I would renew the motion or the objection.
So when you're dealing with...
One important point. Go ahead.
When you're dealing with I-213, well, what is an I-213?
The I-213, I think formal name is Record of Inadmissible or Deportable Alien. And generally, the I-213 is considered to be evidence. Of course, it's signed by someone who is not at the immigration court or is not coming to court with the government's lawyer, but it's generally considered admissible evidence, although there's a very interesting case just decided, unpublished by the board, that's just been released, in which the board terminated proceedings because it believed that the I-213 was unreliable. The case was just, I think, handed down a couple days ago, but it's worth looking at. But the I-213 will generally contain the alien's name, a lot of basic information, address, where the individual was encountered, how the individual was encountered, whether it was released from jail in Dallas County, for example, or if the individual was found on the roadside, or if the individual was encountered at a port of entry or at an interior checkpoint, and then usually contains some narrative about how the arrest or the apprehension took place.
Right, and so in Pujol, those are generally inherently reliable, but in certain instances, it isn't. And there's a court case out of the 7th, Pujol versus Holder, 726 F3rd, 1007, which further said that sometimes they're not inherently reliable. And you can make arguments to exclude these from evidence, certainly the 213s, where the government tends to rely on those as evidence to support their claim that your client should be removed from the United States. When I argue these, and I'm sure you do as well, Joe, in either motions or oral objections, we can always argue that there's one of five different standards that to kind of look for elements. It may contain information that is known to be incorrect. The 213 may have been obtained by coercion or duress. It may have been drafted carelessly. It may have been mischaracterized or misstate material information, or it seems suspicious, or the evidence may have been obtained from someone other than the alien who is the subject of the form. So in the end, I think it ultimately goes to whether there's hearsay evidence, whether you can object to the hearsay evidence, or whether you have a fair opportunity to be able to cross-examine witnesses against you. I'm sorry, go ahead, Joe, and then we're going to finish.
I was just going to mention very quickly, the name of the case I referred to is Michelena Bahamondi. It's B-A-H-A-M-O-N-D-E, in which the board, decided it. Actually, it looks like it was decided in December, but just now is being shared, I think. And that's the case in which the board terminated the proceedings because it said that the I-213 was not reliable. And there is one other case, I believe, it's an older decision in which the board said the 213 was not reliable because it was not signed. The officer who prepared it typed it up and then never signed it.
Well, I would like to thank Mary and Joe for imparting their wisdom on us. It was obviously very interesting, very substantive. I'd like to thank JJ and Ayla, and that would conclude our podcast at this time.